Here's one of the greatest little books I've ever found. Don't try to find it anywhere. You can't. The Story of the Britons by Skinner. Don't even know where it came from. Just found it in a bunch of books that were delivered to me by somebody. Now, by the way, a few years ago, there was a movement founded in England called the Old Straight Paths, where an organization began to believe that all these megalithic stone monuments were not only astronomically oriented to the stars and the skies and revealed a superior knowledge and intellect that defies the concept of evolution, both biological and sociological, as it applies to man, that he started out a savage and got smart like we now are. We ain't as smart as we once were. If nothing else comes of these studies of the pyramid, without the prophetic concept and Stonehenge and others, unraveling the mystery and seeing the real nature of what it took to build these things, reveals a superior intellect and knowledge. The Old Straight Paths argued that they were not only astronomically aligned, but they were aligned with each other along certain straight lines. That so defied the traditions of archaeology, because science adopted a premise, and that premise was that man crawled out of the caves, and the superior intellect of Greece and Rome reached its highest degree of development, and the whole world is in debt to Greece and Rome. And to discover, and they moved westward to find these barbarians, to discover that on the western fringe of these United States, or these European nations, and what Barry Fellows discovered even in these United States, discover Ogham writing and Phoenician writing before people were supposed to know how to write. That blows their theory. And to think that there was an Atlantis, and that maybe somebody in Britain knew something about the same time that they knew it in Egypt, and that everything did not originate in Mesopotamia, that just blew their theories. Plus the fact man had to slowly get smart until he got as smart as the Greeks. And to discover the Greeks weren't as smart as they once were in Egypt, that was bad enough. But to suggest the Greeks weren't as smart as they once were in England, that's heresy. Alexander Thom has spent years with these megalithic monuments, and if you think Stonehenge is something, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, this British Isle beats anything I have ever seen. All of them, even up to the Orkneys and the Shetlands. I have not even scratched the surface. What is this importance of the British Isles? Ages and ages ago, before the twilight of history had dawned, before the people of the continent of Europe had even learned to write, that time the great world itself was little known to anyone. It was assumed to be an immense flat body of land set in the midst of an infinite ocean. No one believed the earth would be round like a ball. Men thought the end of the world was reached when they came to the end of this great body of land. They knew nothing about anything beyond. The people of Europe for a long time didn't even attempt to find anything about Britain. Who would wish to go out of the world? Were there not dangers and troubles enough in the world There were savage beasts and savage men, venomous serpents and poisonous vines, and if other worlds should be discovered, they might contain beasts and men more savage still. From the mainland on a bright day, a glimpse of the coast of Albion could be seen, a range of chalky cliffs gleaming in the morning sunlight. But few indeed were the daring souls that ventured near. Very ancient legend tells us that this island was the abode of hideous monsters. It was covered with deep forests and mighty trees shut out the light of day. Its rivers rolled sullenly to the ocean, sometimes spreading out into noisome fens and sloughs, and it was well suited to be the home of giants. These, the legends tell us, were 18 feet or more in height. When they walked, the earth shook under their tread. One of them could easily carry an ox upon his shoulder. It would have been rare sport for them to seize men by the hair, hold them out at arm's length. The giants were uncouth fellows with long, shaggy hair falling down upon their shoulders. Their faces bore an ugly scowl. Bureaucrats before we shrunk them down to size. They liked the dark recesses of the woods and the mountain caves, where they slept away the long hours of the day, waiting only to wreak vengeance upon any intruder or to seek their prey for the horrid repast of raw flesh in which they indulged. The few shipwrecked sailors who were thrown upon their shore were seized at once by these monsters and carried to their king. This giant king, monarch, was Albion. From his great size and strength, he was made the lord and master of the island. And woe to the hapless person who incurred his wrath. The giants called their country the island of Albion, for he claimed to own the whole of it. No one dared question his title. Albion, it was said, was the son of Neptune, the god of the sea. Neptune ruled over the ocean, riding about it day and night as the commanders of great ships do today, only he could live and ride as well below the surface as above it. First underwater surfer. He spent much of his time in its depths. Old European pictures represent Neptune as riding in a seashell, drawn by seahorses and holding in his hand a three-pointed scepter called a trident, by means of which he ruled the waves. Perhaps it was thought that Albion's island had some right to the use of his father's scepter as a symbol. For the same old artist who drew the pictures of Neptune used to represent the island by drawing a picture of a woman seated upon a rock bearing a trident in her hand. It's been remarked that this old picture was a sort of prophecy that the island would one day rule the sea. But these pictures were made many centuries after Albion's reign. A day was to arrive when the king of the giants should pass away. A great prince, in course of time, was to come to the island and take possession of it. The giants were to fall before the prowess of the prince. Clearings were to be made in the dark forest to let the sunlight in. It was indeed a great day for the world when the advance guard of a new race came to redeem the land from its long and dreadful night. More than three centuries ago, in the days of Queen Elizabeth, the English poet Edmund Spenser described the giants of the island in his poem, The Faerie Queen. The language of this famous poem is so quaint and old-fashioned that it's not always easy to understand, for our words and forms of speech have changed very much since Queen Elizabeth's time. You know what amazes me? People grow up in this country and take English literature, required. They know nothing of where Shakespeare was getting to play King Lear. They know nothing of the source of Tennyson and Woodworth and Spencer. and Milton. We'll see. Here is Spenser's old poem, a stanza from it. But far inland a savage nation dwelt of hideous giants and half-beastly men that never tasted grace nor goodness felt, but wild like beasts lurking in loathsome den. And flying fast as roebuck through the fen, all naked without shame or care of cold, by hunting and by spoiling, livid then, of stature huge and eke of courage bold, that sons of men amazed their sternness to behold. How long a giant might live is not easy to say. There's now no race of giants to check. Now and then people live to be a century old. Giants such as this story describes might live perhaps two or three times as long. Albion's life didn't come to a natural close. Leaving his island, he passed over to the mainland of Europe, where he might prove if there were in the great world any beings who could equal him in strength. On the bank of the Rhone River, he encountered Hercules, a gigantic mythical hero of the Greeks and Romans, of whom are related many of the most charming stories in ancient mythology. Albion was slain in the struggle, and his brother Bergion also lost his life. Albion left in his island a son named Godmur, who grew to be as huge and hideous as himself. Now, Godmur must have been living a long time before the Trojan War, but he survived it for several generations of men, then came to his end by violence, as we shall see later. Am I boring you? That was one of the most famous wars ever known in all the world. It occurred very long ago that history says nothing about it. A great poem called the Iliad of Homer, which was composed and learned long before the time of writing, tells us a great deal concerning it. Far away in what is now called Asia Minor was the nation of the Trojans. Their capital city was called Troy, or Ilium, for it had two names. It was a wonderful city for those times, and the Trojans considered it the greatest capital in the world. They looked down upon the Europeans as being uncivilized, as indeed the most of them were, though the Greeks were fast becoming a powerful and cultural people. Priam was a great and proud king of Troy, but alas, it was his fate to see the utter ruin of his city and the destruction of his nation. Priam's son Paris, who visited one of the Greek kings, was base enough to steal and carry away the wife of his host. The name of this queen was Helen, and she was known as the most beautiful woman in the world. The face that launched 1,000 ships. The kings of the Greek states united to make war on Troy. The Achaeans to fight the Danaans. Dardanus, son of Zara, son of Judah, he with the twine round his red thread round his wrist, son of Israel, son of Isaac, of the scepter line, displaced by Pharaohs, whose name means breach, whose lines came to rule through David perpetually over Judah and Israel, but perpetually over Judah, to produce the Son of God in Christ. Zara's son Dardanus founds Troy. Troy was considered myth. This guy wasn't even convinced. He wrote in 1903. Schliemann, as you know, took Homer as Bible and began to read and discovered Troy, and Tyrrhenes, and Agamemnon's mask. The kings of Greece were not natives They came about the time that Troy was formed, also from Egypt. Another son of Zarah forms the leading kingdom of the Greek city-states. The tribes are at war, as they were through the whole book of Judges. And you have sons of Israel through Zarah as the kings of Greece, who ruled and brought the knowledge and culture from Egypt to Greece, fighting against Troy. You say, well, you haven't proved that yet. Just wait. But assume it for the moment. For 10 years, the city was besieged by the allied armies of the Greek city-states. Another descendant of Zarah founded them. The kingly line of Zarah has founded Troy. Priam, the king, has many sons. Paris had stolen Helen. The Iliad is the story of the battle. The Odyssey is the story of the return of the heroes back home. How many of you know of Virgil, the great Latin poet's Aeneid? The Grecian poet, Homer, told the story of the Battle of Troy and the return of the heroes in his Iliad and Odyssey. Generations have grown up. The time had not yet come for the discovery of the connection. Now the pioneer work of Cyrus S. Gordon and his successor students and admirers have shown the connection and the common source of the Greek and Hebrew culture in Egypt. Whereas shepherd kings they ruled, and then Upper Egypt drove them out, the leaders left. The ordinary people stayed as slaves to come out under Moses. Just keep going. Virgil will pick up where Homer leaves off. For 10 years, the city was besieged by the allied armies. Last, it fell into the hands of the Greeks by a clever stratagem, of which perhaps you've read, the Trojan Horse. It was night when the thousands of Greeks burst into the city, carrying everywhere the torch and the sword, destroying the houses and the people. And then a paragraph picks up that leaps from Grecian literature. The Grecian litter will pick up the return of the heroes. The Grecian litter will pick up the story of Jason and his 50 Argonauts, who land at Libya and become the source of the mysterious information that the Dogon people have, which via Jason and Colchis and Delphi and Egypt takes us back to a superior knowledge. Another story is told by the Latin poet who wrote in the time of Augustus Caesar, Virgil. He tells the story of Aeneas. Among the Trojans who escaped from the burning city was Aeneas. He witnessed the grief of Priam when Achilles killed Hector and despoiled his body. He witnessed the slaying of Priam. His father was a great hero. He was not the son of the Trojan king. He was the son of a brother of the Trojan king, still a descendant of Dardanus, of the line of Zarah. He marries the daughter of Priam. He confronts Achilles. Having witnessed the death of Priam, he confronts Achilles, the one who killed Hector, escapes in a miracle, as the story tells it, because it was prophesied of Aeneas that he would reestablish the Trojan line in a four country. So among the Trojans who escaped from the burning city was Aeneas. Virgil's great poem, The Aeneid, has him land at Carthage and on request tells in retrospect the story of the siege and fall of Troy and the journey to Carthage before he goes to Italy. That's the great Latin poet and poem that picks up where Homer leaves off. He escaped the burning city, carried his aged father upon his back, and led his little boy. You won't get this in Homer. Homer tells of the Grecians coming home, Ulysses, the Odyssey. Virgil tells of Aeneas' escape from Troy. Carried his aged father upon his back, led his little boy Ascanius by the hand till he reached the seashore. He later, with many other brave men, set forth in vessels upon the Aegean Sea, leaving far behind the scene of the great fire of the burning of Troy. He did not land in Greece, for the Greeks were his enemies. On and on he sailed to the westward. It's all in Virgil's poem. Over the vast Mediterranean, which seemed to him more immense than the ocean seems to us today. No such voyage had been made before that he knew of. He didn't know what lands he would reach, but he followed the star Venus in the western sky and came at last, it is said, to Carthage, an ancient city which stood where Tunis is now on the coast of Africa. The Roman poet Virgil has related in his great Latin poem called The Aeneid the story of this wonderful voyage. From Carthage, Aeneas went to Italy, where he was well received by the king of the Latin country. His wife having perished at Troy, he accepted the king's offer of the king's daughter's hand in marriage. Aeneas remained in the fair land of Italy, where he wasn't molested by the Greeks and where his descendants multiplied, handing down his memories of the illustrious ancestors and the heroic deeds of old Troy. Now, you know your legends about the founding of Rome. Know the story of Romulus and Remus, set adrift by their cruel guardian, nursed and raised by wolves, as the legend goes. One of his descendants, Aeneas, was Romulus, who founded the city of Rome, which finally became the capital of all the known world. Just simply too amazing to be true. Virgil, like Homer, made the whole thing up. Because there ain't no way God could work his will this way. He said to Sarah and Abram, kings will come out of you. God enters into all things to work his good. Do you realize that chapter in Genesis about Tamar and Judah shouldn't even be in the Bible? And that God could turn that event into a competitive situation of twins who, because of the arm that came forth with a red thread placed around it by the midwife, withdrawn, and then Pharaoh born first, would create that competition for the promise given to Judah, the scepter will not depart from you in lawmaking. God could not enter into that. Such a situation. He wouldn't get near it with a 10-foot pole. In fact, if he had had his way, he would have kept it out of his Bible, but some dirty-minded old monk put it in there. God had said, kings, been centuries, we've been beaten down by traditions. The Greeks and Romans sprang up indigenously. Well, we'll see. The Romans were very proud of their descent from the Trojans until some German historians decided they couldn't afford such connections. And Virgil and Homer were made out to be liars and fantasy storytellers, just like Grimm's fairy tales. They don't have any basis in any meaning. They just what they are, just plain old Hollywood of the Middle Ages. Jack and the Beanstalk, anybody knows there ain't no such thing as giants. The Romans were very proud of their descent from the Trojans. How many of you grew up and went to school and learned about Rome? How many of you grew up and went to school? How many of you grew up? How many of you grew up, went to school, studied history, and nobody ever connected the Trojans to Rome? Let me see your hand. Most of you, that's what I thought. In later ages, the Greeks, who fancied themselves the only great people of the world, were apt to boast very much of their ancestors who fought in the Trojan War. And the Romans would haughtily reply, "Yes, but we also are descendants of heroes who fought in the same war. We are the Trojans." A descendant of Zara lands, marries the daughter of the king, and produces Romulus. Well, how much truth there is in Virgil's story of Aeneas, we don't know. Doubtless this sport made the most of all the legends of the people that connected them with the East. Well, they said Homer made it up. Aeneas did not find that the heroic struggles of his life were over when he ceased his wanderings and resolved to end his days among the Latin people of Italy. Am I boring you? Lavinia, the beautiful daughter of the king Latinus, had been promised to Turnus, the king of a neighboring nation called the Rutuli. At least this was what Turnus claimed. Accordingly, he made war upon the Latins. Aeneas was ready to fight for his young bride. How many of you remember Homer? Everybody's heard of him. Helen, the face that launched 1,000 ships. What most people do not know is that one of the sons of Zara, that twin whose hand burst forth from the womb and got the red string tied around his wrist to mark him as the first to break forth, the hand went back in the womb, and then Phares is born first. That strange chapter in Genesis where the twins of Judah and Tamar is born. Now, if you were a son of Zara, and your cousins were the son of Phares, and God, through Jacob, gave the promise and said the scepter, that is, the rulership, will never depart from the house of Judah, and the right to make the laws will never depart from the house of Judah. Would you, just out of hand, yield the territory to your cousins, the son of Phares? They would say, "Our dad was born first." And you would say, "What does first mean? Our dad's hand came out first." Now, in a horse race, whichever nose crosses the line first wins. At least it's debatable. If that midwife had, she was a troublemaker. Telling you, there's one in every church. She tied that red. No wonder red tapes become such a damnable irritation down through the years. That woman started it.
woman ate an apple. A woman tied that tape. And men been copping out ever since. You may say, which side are you on that for me and God to know? And when we all get to heaven, and we're all men over there, then I'll tell you. Then I'll tell you. If we all end up women, you tell me, will you? God, what a horrible thought on a Sunday afternoon. Now, I ask you. I ask you now, be honest, women. Do you want a heaven? Don't reply. Just keep the answer to yourself. Do you really want a heaven that's nothing but women? Just think about it. Just 1 minute, just think about it. Nice men, we'd be happy over there. No women anywhere. Occasional leave out of hell with someone to clean the house. I mean, the stove's down there so they can do the cooking. Slaving over a hot stove in hell. They'll be glad to come out and just serve us men up there. Of course, if we're all women up there, we'll let the men do the cooking. Down below. Down below, Lord. Down below. Homer, that's what we were talking about, wasn't it? Homer told the tale. He wasn't believed to be historic until the mid-1800s when Schliemann uncovered Troy by taking Homer as Bible. I mean, he'd been around a long time, but nobody believed him. I mean, come to think of it, that's pretty tough. The guy disbelieved for more than 2,000 years. Schliemann dug up Troy and had to take a new look at Homer. Still don't like the look, most the traditionalists. So they're not going to find it easy to leap from Homer to Virgil and from Virgil to Geoffrey of Monmouth. And we grow up and study English literature. Spencer, Thackeray, Shakespeare, doesn't matter. All myth. But what if it's true? Now you see, there were two exodus out of Egypt. The rulers left when Upper Egypt rebelled against that second wave of shepherd kings that took the power that had been given to Joseph and exercised it cruelly. Dardanus, the son of Zorah, felt fully justified to found a kingdom called Troy. What about Chalco? The other sons, one of them went to Greece. And those city-states were not indigenous Grecians. They were ruled by those descendants of Zorah who left Egypt and founded these cities, Judah line. Troy was founded by Dardanus, and the place became a haven for the Danaans. Dan will judge or mark the people and signify them as legit, like a judge seals and marks the evidentiary record. We'll find those same Danaans, the Tuatha De Danann,
in Ireland. Very few of the people, everybody's Irish last night. Very few of them know anything about their heritage and history. I wear the green hat with knowledge. I guess they think St. Patrick invented whiskey. He didn't even rid the island of snakes. He didn't even Christianize the island. It'd already been done, but we make void everything by traditions. But back to Troy. Homer tells the story in the Iliad of the heroic battle to defeat Troy, and it ends with the burial of Hector. It has an interesting line at the end of the Iliad. Hector, the tamer of horses. By the way, it's the same word that's used when it says Moses was a meek man. It means tame man. All the power, all the strength, all the life's there, just brought under control. Hector is credited, the end of the Iliad, some strange reason, tamer of horses. That ought to be a clue to you, but I'll leave that dangling and go on. The Odyssey is the story of the return of the heroes. From the Grecian view, also sons of Zara, and that great Grecian kingdom was led by that descendant line of the blessed people that had been given the blessing by God. Say what you will, God's going to be in control. From the Trojan side, the great Latin poet Virgil tells the story of Aeneas, nephew of Priam, king of Troy, son of a brother of Priam, descendant of Dardanus, descendant of Zara, descendant of Judah, wed to the daughter of Priam, who flees Troy. And in the Aeneid, written by Virgil, you have the story of Aeneas, who flees with his aged father on his back, his little boy, Ascanius, by his hand, his wife following. She is somehow taken and disappears. He flees through the Mediterranean, lands in Carthage, North Africa, and recounts the story, then goes to Rome, settles in Italy, having lost his wife in Troy, is given the promise to wed of the Latin king's daughter. But he finds his struggles are not over. All this is in Virgil's poem. Lavinia, the beautiful daughter of the king Latinus, that is now promised to Aeneas, Turnus, of a neighboring nation, king of the Rutuli, claims she's promised to him. I'm telling you, these descendants of Abraham have women problems. I mean, this commission, sand and star, makes them fight for every chance they get. Each one of them, divinely appointed to do the whole job himself. Turnus claimed Latinus was his. He made war upon the Latins for breach of promise. Aeneas was ready to fight for his young bride and proved as ever a gallant warrior. He defeated Turnus and slew him with his own hand. He got Lavinia,
After the death of Latinus, Aeneas succeeded him as king of the Latins. Aeneas' son Ascanius, that had been led as a small child in the flight from Troy, undertook the building of a new kingdom in the unoccupied country nearby and founded the city of Alba. Here a son was born to him named Silvius. This son, when he became a young man, secretly married a niece of Lavinia, his mother. When Ascanius learned of this, he was much alarmed, for he heard at the same time a fearful prophecy concerning a grandson of his yet to be born. The prophecy was to the effect that the child of Silvius should destroy his own father and mother, but it added that he should wander far over the earth and should become eventually a great and illustrious hero. A son was born to Silvius. The mother died in childbirth. The child was a bright and promising boy and loved his father, and little attention was given to the further fulfillment of the prophecy concerning him. His name was Brute, or Brutus, as he is called in the Latin language. When Brutus was 15 years of age, he was engaged one day in hunting in company with his father Silvius when a dreadful accident occurred. An arrow, which the boy aimed at a stag, glanced to one side and entered his father's breast. The bow had been strongly bent. The wound was fatal. Under the custom of the day, the son who killed his father was deemed accursed, however innocent might have been his intent. And King Ascanius, the young boy grown up, whose grandson, Brute, had killed his son, the son of Ascanius, the father of Brute, Ascanius was compelled to banish his grandson from the realm. Thus, at a tender age, the child of prophecy went forth alone into the world. His mind was filled with thoughts of the illustrious deeds of Aeneas. He wandered away to the east to learn what had become of his old relatives, the comrades of his great-grandfather, if any had survived, or any of their descendants. He came at length to Greece and found himself in the land of a king named Pandrasus. In this country, there were descendants of many of the Trojan captives who were slaves, for the ancient nation made slaves of their prisoners of war. Brute enlisted as a soldier of the king, but took care to cultivate the friendship of all the Trojan slaves. And now we will move from Virgil to Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of England. I mean, if Homer is fake, then Virgil's fake. And if Homer and Virgil are fake, then Geoffrey's fake. But if Homer has bases in fact, whatever exaggerations may be credited to him, then maybe Virgil had bases in fact, and maybe Geoffrey had bases in fact. But after 2,000 years of whipping Homer, give a little time for Virgil and Geoffrey to gain credibility, and people like me to cross check and add more weight of evidence. He learned, Brute enlisted as a soldier of the king, but took care to cultivate the friendship of all the Trojan slaves. He learned their grievances, encouraged their aspirations for freedom. He won fame in the army, for as he grew older, he grew in power and skill. The Trojans in Greece, however, were so oppressed, they couldn't help him much with any uprising, as he considered rebellion. He needed help. Fortunately, he found a suitable man in Assaracus, the son of a Greek noble. The mother of Assaracus was a Trojan slave. Her father's other son was the child of a proud Greek lady. And while the father gave his wealth to both boys, there was jealousy and enmity between them. So Brute encouraged Assaracus to take great pride in his Trojan ancestry and espouse the cause of his kinsman in bondage.
Assaracus placed his castles at their disposal because his mother had been a Trojan, and an uprising was speedily planned. 3,000 of the Trojan slaves suddenly assembled at these strongholds, placed themselves under the command of Brute. The latter at once sent a message to King Pandrasus demanding the immediate emancipation of his followers. This was denied by the king, who instantly led forth his army to suppress the insurrection. Brute managed to intercept and surprise him on the way. The armies met on the banks of the river Acheron. Here Antigonus, a brother of the king, was taken prisoner together with his friend and companion Anacletus. The royal army was repulsed. Brute placed a garrison in his stronghold of Spartanum, but kept his main force in the field or among the hills where he might retreat if necessary. The king's forces advanced upon Spartanum, and the furious siege ensued. Heavy engines of war were set to work to demolish the walls. The garrison was threatened with destruction. Brute, learning of this, not daring to risk a battle with even chances of victory, had recourse to stratagem. He determined to secure, if possible, possession of the king's person at night. By a threat of instant death, he compelled his two illustrious prisoners, Antigonus and Anacletus, to aid him in a clever scheme. In the dead of night, Brute's army was to draw near in silence, concealed by the darkness. Anacletus was to advance to the sentinels of the Greek camp and tell them a pitiful story of the king's brother. Antigonus, he was to say, is bound with heavy chains. That was the Greek king's brother. I succeeded in escaping with him and have carried him here nearly all the way. I had to leave him at the edge of the forest, for could carry him no further, and for heaven's sake, leave your post a few minutes and bring him in. The stratagem succeeded admirably. The sentinels advanced without suspicion and were quickly seized by the Trojans. Skillfully did Brute post his forces in the silence and darkness, then at a given signal, reminiscent of Gideon, a rush was made. The king was taken prisoner in his pavilion, and the Greeks were overpowered as they awakened from sleep. King Pandrasus, like the Pharaoh of Scripture, now consented that the slaves should depart. If they should so insist, was willing to give them 1/3 of his kingdom if they'd remain. To the latter, the Trojans would not agree. The prophecy regarding their leader was to be fulfilled. He would lead them to a land where they'd build a new Troy and revive the fame of their ancestors. King Pandrasus gave them hundreds of ships, a large amount of gold and silver. More reluctantly, perhaps, he gave his daughter, Ignogi. Now, Ignogi, dear, to be the bride of the victorious Brute. Do you, Brute, take Ignogi? Do you, Ignogi, take Brute? The Trojans left. As soon as possible, the ships were loaded and manned, sailed away from Greece, never to return. The last the Greeks saw of them was Ignogi, fainting in the arms of her young husband as the vessels sailed out of the bay. Am I boring you? On and on sped the Trojan ships over the blue Mediterranean, which the fleet of Aeneas had traversed many years before. The long slavery of the Trojans was over. Under the leadership of Brute, who had been sent to them in fulfillment of prophecy, they were going forth to build a new Troy. Fair winds blew. The vessels held on their way. They came to an island called Laodicea. Brute landed with some of his followers, found the island was uninhabited. At a temple, he receives a prophecy. This is the prophecy. Brutus, there lies beyond the Gaelic bounds an island which the western sea surrounds. By giants once possessed, now few remain to bar thy entrance or obstruct thy reign. To reach that happy shore, thy sails employ. There fate decrees to raise another Troy and pound an empire in thy royal line, which time shall ne'er destroy. nor bounds confined. You say, how did he get a poem in Greek that rhymes in English? How do you know he got it in Greek? Plus, this is the record of later days, placed to poetry by bards who told the story orally and exercised poetic license to put it to rhyme in the oft-repeated telling. These people are going to end up in Wales. They'll speak Gaelic. By the way, in the Old Testament, it says, other tongues will I speak to this people, it's Gaelic will I speak to these people. Just thought I'd throw that in. The spirit of the young prince was at once raised to the highest pitch of enthusiasm. He imparted to his followers the experience the following day. On they sailed to the Philinian altars and to Selinia. They came to Mauritania, which is now Morocco on the north coast of Africa. Would have sailed through the strait, that's Gibraltar, into the Atlantic, but for the sea monsters which threatened to wreck their ship. They turned back towards Italy and landed somewhere on the shores of the Tyrrhenian Sea, not far from the realms of the Latins and the Albans. Here, to their surprise, they found people who spoke their language. It proved to be like themselves, descendants of the brave men of old Troy. Chief among the newfound friends of these relatives was Corineus, a young man of marvelous strength and courage. He was destined to fill the world with his fame as a giant killer. Such a man Brute would need in the island which he was to seek in the ocean. For the goddess had told him that some of the giants still remained there. Corineus agreed to accompany Brute. And a large number of the Trojans of the four kingdoms also joined the expedition. With many new ships and a vast company of men, women, and children, the fleet of Brute again set sail. Am I boring you? And now passed through Gibraltar into the untried Atlantic. Turning northward in the ocean, they sailed across the Bay of Biscay and came to the country of Aquitaine, which is now southwestern France. Landing here, they found themselves in the dominion of a king named Gaufrius Pictus. Unfortunately, a quarrel arose. The Dutching Corineus killed the king's general in a hand-to-hand fight, and a great war followed. The principal battle was fought at Tours. Here, Turonus, a Trojan hero, killed 600 men with his heavy sword, cleaving their trunks often with a single stroke. You ought to read the book of Judges if you think this is bloody. David's mighty men did things like that. The terrific contest over, Brute again set sail and followed up the coast of Gaul until he saw to the northward the shores of the vast island which he was destined to rule. His voyage was ended. He had far outdone his great-grandfather Aeneas that Virgil wrote of, for he had sailed out of the world and into the great ocean. Rome had not yet been founded, nor was it to be realized in its power for centuries to come. They would go back to Romulus, whose lineage would trace also to Aeneas, to Zara, to Judah, to Israel, to Isaac, to Abraham, to Shem, to Seth. But a mightier than Romulus was this Brute, and earlier by many generations. Traditions notwithstanding, with sails full spread, with banners proudly streaming, the Trojan fleet sped on to the Isle of Albion, in the sheltered harbor of Totnes, in what is now Devonshire, England. The ships came to anchor and the multitude debarked upon the strand. You can find the monument there today. Yet people live and die in the English heritage and know nothing of the landing of Brute at Totnes. No poem equal to the Aeneid has ever been written to describe the expedition of Brute, as Virgil related the exploits of Aeneas. Yet the landing of the Trojans in Albion is a subject possessing a high degree of poetic interest. It is connected with the first settlement of a vast island which was destined after thousands of years to be the seat of the greatest empire the world has ever known, no exceptions. 700 years ago, indeed, the story was told in a long and remarkable poem, you English literature buffs, listen, by Lyamon, an English priest. This has been considered the first narrative poem written in our language. Yet you'll take English Lit 101, and they won't even mention it. Blows the traditions. Certainly it was the first one written after the Norman conquest, which caused the old Anglo-Saxon to be gradually transformed into English. Our language has changed so greatly since Lyamon's time, come over here, that you would scarcely be able to understand one of its thousands of short lines without help. The poem is preserved today as a curious relic of old literature, and only a few patient scholars attempt to read much of it. Here is a paragraph taken from the beginning of the second book. It's the one most frequently used as a specimen of the whole. Can you get in close enough? And priost was on Ilden, which means a priest was in the land. Lyamon was he Houghton? Lyamon was he called. He was, whatever the heck that next thing is pronounced as, Leonibesum. He was Leovinus' son. Let him be old Breton. Maybe it's Brighton. May he be blessed. You say you don't pronounce it right. Anything's right, my friend. Nobody knows. He wanted in Ernlivie. He lived at Ernley. The translations are clear. Nobody knows exactly how to pronounce it, though I'm quite sure those that still have the relics of the language would be closer than me. It was a pleasant experience. He lived at Ernley at a noble church upon Severn's Bank. Good, he thought it there, fast by Raidstone, where books he read, it came to him in mind and in his chief thoughts that he would of England the noble deeds tell, what they were named and whence they came, who the English land first possessed after the flood, which from God came that destroyed all those living whom it found. That's what that page says. It was a pleasant experience for the Trojans. How many of you grew up, took English literature, never heard of this poor guy, Lyamon? First narrative poem. It was a pleasant experience for the Trojans to find themselves at last in the land which was to be their own. What I want you to get across is, what I want to get across, want you to get, is history is exactly what it says, his story. It's what people want you to hear. You need somebody like me that's crazy enough to read 4 or 5 books a day and sort of dig the stuff aside till we can get to the bottom of some things. Guided by a pretty good premise, that God's in charge, and if you look deep enough, you'll find the strands he's weaving. It was a pleasant experience for the Trojans to find themselves at last in a land which was to be their own. The shore of Totnes was very agreeable to the view and did not suggest the deep, dark forests of the interior. Here the Trojans gave themselves up to rejoicing for a time and made plans for the glorious future which they were to have. To Brute they gave all praise, and it was determined at the outset that the land should be named in his honor. The hero's name had been pronounced in Greece very much as though it were spelt Brit, for the Greeks had always had a Frenchy way of pronouncing the vowel you. Thus it came that the name which the Trojans gave to the land sounded very much like Britain, Brutes land. And the people were British, Brutes people. Now there are people who have said, etymologically it means, brute means covenant. Covenant land, covenant man. Brute was a child of prophecy. His name conveyed the meaning of his existence. As Abram became Abraham, Abram means high father. When God gave him the promise of many sons, his name was changed to Abraham. As Sarai's name was changed to Sarah when God gave her a promise. And Jacob, which means heel catcher, became Israel, prince that has power with God, when God gave him the promise in the breaking moment at the brook where he wrestled all night. Brute, a child of promise, as many were named when they were born. Covenant, he's the child of covenant. Both the etymologists and the history names it covenant land, covenant man, brutes land, brutes people. Covenant land, covenant people, covenant man, ish man. Probably the first plans of Brute related to the building of a city, which was to be the new Troy of the prophecy. But before he could arrange for this, he was drawn into a contest with the hideous giants who disrupted his possession of the land. Ah, here we go again. Baloney. Just like the book of Joshua. Baloney. You see, it's okay to read that in Joshua. It's okay to read that about David. But the only ones that existed were those there in that promised land on that hill that Caleb wanted. My traditions would not let a giant be anywhere else and have a hard enough time swallowing that because it's in the Bible. I mean, God can get away with telling a lie like that, but nobody else. I warn you. These giants. Now it was that the wonderful skill and strength of Corineus were of the greatest service. Many are the stories told of this hero's contest with the terrible creatures. Well, now, these people, I'm telling you, had problems. They wanted to copy an inheritance like the Bible inheritance, so they had to have their David and their Goliath and their... Hey, wait a minute. Maybe the Bible copied this. Or maybe they were both true. You see, rhetoric gets you nowhere. It's time the evangelical world learned this history and then deal with it objectively. Many of the stories told of this hero's contest with the terrible creatures. In the storybooks, Jack the Giant Killer appears as a boy. In the story of Brute, he's a full-grown man, though not a very large man. His strength was wonderful, and his audacity astonishing. Giant, you smart alecks, you think you figure something out, don't you? Giant after giant fell before his strokes or became a victim of his cunning stratagem. Why is this Jack the Giant Killer in the Anglo-Saxon heritage? Why Hans and Gretel there? It's Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. One of the most ferocious of these giants. One of the most ferocious of these giants was a huge fellow named Gomagot. Came one day with 20 others to a place near the shore where the Trojans were feasting. Brute and his followers determined not to show any sign of fear. 20 of them. Led by Gomagot. The giants pretended to be good-natured and challenged.
anyone of the Trojan party to a wrestling match with Gomagot. God's people always got idiots like this come around bothering them. Corony has volunteered for a little friendly sparring. Was on the lookout for treachery. Gomagot grasped him with the grip of a vice and broke three of his ribs, two on his right side and one on his left. And that made him mad. He's an ancestor of the Texans and the Kentuckians, what he is. Stung with pain. Am I boring you? Stung with pain and maddened at the treachery of his huge antagonist, why hasn't somebody else read this on TV? I mean, the book was written in 1903. Stung with pain, maddened at the treachery of his huge antagonist, Corony has put forth almost superhuman strength in the mightiest effort of his life, catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, then, and then, do you know the Bible says you're as guilty as a murderer if you hate somebody in your heart? That's what it says right there in the New Testament to King James. It says you hate somebody, you're guilty as a murderer. Jesus' law prevailed, we'd call the cops and arrest people all over this room. And then, catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, yes, he did. He really did. What I said. I don't know whether anybody's listening in Kentucky or not. Why should I go any further? You want to know what the thens are? The thems and theirs get pretty interesting. And then, let's all say it together now. And then, what I said. And then, you know that the great English poet Spenser wrote of this? Of mighty Golmoot, whom in stout fray Coroneus should know all about this, shouldn't even need it read to you. You had English literature, it's required in college and high school. Everybody knows this. What's the fact? You know, the pilgrims set sail right from this spot, right here. It was called Lamb Gomagot. Why should I read anymore? And then, I just love to do this. One of the most ferocious of these giants was a huge fellow named Gomagot, who came one day with 20 others to a place near the shore where the Trojans were feasting. Brute. Do you want to end up like Gomagot? Brute and his followers determined not to show any sign of fear. The giants pretended to be good-natured and challenged any one of the Trojan party, any of them, to a wrestling match with Gomagot. Isn't that the way Goliath did it? Corini has volunteered for a little friendly sparring, but was on the lookout for treachery. Gomagot grasped him with the grip of a vice and broke three of his ribs, two on his right side and one on his left. Oh, I read all that, didn't I? Yeah. Stung with pain and maddened at the treachery of his huge antagonist, Corony has put forth almost superhuman strength
in the mightiest effort of his life. I read that too tonight. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, well, you can memorize the whole line. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. Now, this is not nearly as dirty a deed as that wicked lover's. I mean, this should have been done. I really believe this should have been done. A little kindness, like Paul put forth this morning. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. Over what? And then, you're getting pretty good at it. You really are. In fact, it's rather entertaining. Let's do it again. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. Let's practice on each other. Have a real ducky horror show here. Catching the giant, well, there ain't no giants here though. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, just think of the people that turned on 99.5 to hear this. They intended to stay on only 5 minutes, and they're already here 10 whole minutes. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, you know, there are some people that think I won't finish. Evil thoughts. Now, will I or won't I? We'll see, won't we? Catching the giant at a disadvantage. Now, that's the way to handle a giant. Topple them over. That's what they did in Gulliver's Travel, isn't it? Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, before, nobody that called me guessed that would be the next word. Before. And then before. How do you have, how does an and then become a before? Catching the giant at a disadvantage. Sunday, you shouldn't feel that way toward your pastor and teacher. Not on Sunday. Not on Sunday. You shouldn't. Naughty, 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 naughty. Catching the giant at a disadvantage, he toppled him over. And then, before the giant could recover himself, half carried, half dragged him to the cliff overlooking the sea and hurled him down into the abyss. Are really easy to please. The very place where this is said to have occurred is pointed out to this day. Now, the people grow up, live and die, English heritage, never know about Totnes. Now, they don't know about this either. It is near Plymouth, England, the old city from which the pilgrims sailed. It was long ago called Llangollen, which means Gomagot's leap. The English call it the Haw. The English call it the Haw. Long ago, the name was spelled H-O-G-H.
Now, another of the followers of Brute who won fame as a giant killer was Debbin, who contrived to induce the huge Krulin, another giant, to jump across a deep pit more than 130 feet wide. You want a picture of Corineus and Gomagot? There it is. An old Gomagot. Get a close picture of that. Looks like some deacons I've known. An old Gomagot. Now look at little old Corineus. About to hit him in the right place, all I got to say. I mean, if you're going to shove somebody over a cliff, make sure you hit him in the painful parts. I mean, I'm just looking at the picture, you know. I mean, if you're little, take every advantage you got. That's what my granddad taught me. That make sure you hit him where they can't hit you back. Then were my peaceful days. Another of the followers of Brute who won fame as a giant killer was Debbin. Interesting picture. There goes old Gomagot. He Gomagot, all right. Another of the followers of Brute who won fame as a giant killer was Debbin, who contrived to induce the huge Krulin to jump across a deep pit more than 130 feet wide. The giant cleared the pit at a leap, but on his return he tripped, just like a bureaucrat. As the clever Debbin had planned, and tumbled into the chasm, where he was easily dispatched. Another of the giants was Albion's son, Goldmer, who determined to kill Canutus, deeming him a dangerous enemy of the giant race. In his rage, Goldmer hurled great boulders against him, but he only tired himself out with this kind of warfare, for the spry Trojan had no trouble in dodging the missiles of his slow and lumbering enemy, finally found an opportunity to overthrow and kill him. Now that pit into which Krulin fell, and the enormous stones hurled by Godmer are mentioned by Spencer. Now, you will find this in your... In fact, I checked it just last night. I sent one of my guys to get the textbook in English literature over here at USC. But at least they mention Spencer's Fairy Queen. As witnesses of the storied contest of the early Trojans with the giants... You really like to see those giants fall, don't you? Spencer's account of the war with the giants is contained in these quaint stanzas which follow his first mention of Brute. You should have read this, part of your English literature course. But ere he had established his throne and spread his empire to the utmost shore, he fought great battles with his savage foam, in which he defeated them evermore. That's Brute. And many giants left on groaning floor that well can witness yet unto this day. The western hall be sprinkled with the gore of mighty Gomut, whom in stout fray Corineus conquered and cruelly did slay. And in that ample pit yet for renowned, for the large leap which Debbin did compel, Krulin to make, being 8 leagues of ground, into the which returning back he fell.
But those three monstrous stones do most excel, which that huge son of hideous Albion, whose father Hercules in France did quell, great Godmer threw in fierce contention, that bold Canutus, but of him was slain anon. After the giants were killed, Brute rewarded the heroes who had conquered them. To Corineus he gave the strip of the seashore to the southwest, which long bore the name of its owner. Succeeding ages have corrupted Corineus, the land given to him, into Cornwall. Devon's share of the island is now Devonshire. Not much changed in sound, as you will perceive. What'd they teach you all in English history? Nothing, huh? You get to heaven, you ought to punch your teachers in the nose. And now for the building of the city which was to become the seat of the world's greatest empire. Like the Troy of old and like the Rome that was yet to be, this was not built immediately upon the seashore, but some miles from the sea, where a sluggish river broadened out and the banks were level. When the site was once chosen, the city rose as by magic. The forests about it were cleared and the fields were sown. The town lay on the north bank of the river. It was soon humming with industry. Its streets were thronged with people. Its shops were filled with merchandise of Trojan art. Its riverfront was lined with boats. Troy Navant, or New Troy, was the name given to the rising metropolis. Its temples, that's the original name of London, my friend. Its temples contained altars for the worship of old gods of Greece and Troy. Its priests offered sacrifices to propitiate these divinities. The future greatness of Troy Navant was the constant theme of the Troy Navantes. Thus, in the dim twilight of time, long before the dawn of history, it would seem, was founded the city which is the metropolis of the world today. Spencer says, you should have read this, for loyal Britons sprung from Trojans bold, and Troy Navant was built of old Troy's ashes cold. Come, you haven't read this. You haven't read Fairy Queen? A thousand years later, when the Romans were conquering the island, they found the city inhabited by a brave and powerful people whom they called in their histories the Trinobantes. That's about as near as the Romans ever came to getting the correct name for a foreign nation. Trinobantes, Troy Navantes. The Romans held possession of Britain for several centuries. Then came the Angles and Saxons, then the Danes and Northmen, then the Norman French. And through all the long course of written history from the Roman times to the present, and you see, they were called barbarians. They didn't have a written language until Ogham was discovered. 500 BC, seafaring extensions of these western islands carried Ogham into the new country and up the rivers of North America and into the rivers of South America. We thought hieroglyphics was picture writing on the walls of the caves until Champollion broke it and discovered it was an alphabet. I wonder what made us have the arrogance to believe, as historians, that those markings, Ogham, from a seafaring people who would mark them on rocks and wood did not represent writing. The Druids, who spent 20 years in training before they could become a priest, were called barbarians because history assumed the first written records of Britain, Caesar's memoirs. They'd been writing there long before he came. Now the knowledge that built the megalithic circles and the lays and the old straight paths and laid out Stonehenge and Avebury, now we know that someone was there with a brilliance that links them to Egypt. And this story says they are part of the blessed line. Indeed, God now has his kings at Troy, descendants of Judah. They're gone now. Had his kings at Greece, his king at Rome, and now his king at Britain. Methinks he kept his word to Abram and Sarah. He didn't need the remnant of the Jews to keep that promise, though the Jews are part of his promised people. He'll keep the rest of it. Are those stories of the giants true? I don't know. David killed one. Caleb killed some. Or did they find those mastodon and mammoth bones, because they were so big, invent the stories of the giants? Did the Phoenician sailors, to protect the tin mines, invent the story of giants? I don't know. I just think it's a shame that America is so ignorant about this history. You don't have to believe all the details, though you don't have to disbelieve them either. I mean, why did the Bible find the only giants that existed? Critics tell us that the name Albion comes from the old Celtic word alb or alp, which means a mountain or a cliff. Well, whoop-de-doo. They come from the same family. Where did the Britons come from? Well, let's follow the story of Brute, see how strong it is. If the story of the early kings of Troy and Avance, doubtful, so must it be said, doubtful of the narrative of the early kings of Rome. We have no trouble believing about Rome and Greece. Why Britain? A demoniac conspiracy to hide the fact of a select territory that is as important to God as Israel itself.